Okay, good afternoon, everyone, and a very warm welcome to the Friday lunchtime lecture of the Lauterbach Center for International Law, which is kindly sponsored by Cambridge University Press. It is my great pleasure today to chair the panel with Professor Monica Hakimi, who is the James Campbell Professor of Law at the University of Michigan. Her academic interests lie in the fields of public international law and foreign relations law, and her research ties together doctrine and theory to examine how international law operates and adapts to contemporary challenges. Prior to joining the University of Michigan, Monica did her JD at Yale. She clerked at the US District Court and served as an attorney at the US Department of State. She has also acted as counsel before the Iran US Claims Tribunal, the International Court of Justice, and US federal courts and agencies. Today, Monica is going to talk to us about the two visions of the international rule of law. So without further ado, I pass the floor to Monica. Thank you for being here with us today.
Great. Thank you so much, Rumi, for that introduction. And thanks to all of you who are tuning in at home to join us today. It's really delightful to be here. I'm sorry that we can't get together in person. So perhaps like many of you, I've been thinking a lot over the past few years about my commitment to international law, about what I value in it and why, because we seem to be at a transition point. International law is, like all law, a product of the social and political conditions in which it operates. And these conditions seem to be changing. There are many factors in play, so to name just a few, America is no longer as committed as it once was to playing its outsized role in constructing the global order. Even if it were, its geopolitical position, especially relative to China, is changing. Nationalist movements have sprouted up in different parts of the world, and the humanitarian impulses that were for many years ascendant in international law now seem in decline, as is evident in the apparent listlessness of the International Criminal Court, in Europe's migration crisis, and in the complete failure to address gross and systemic human rights abuses of the sort committed in Syria and against the Uyghur Muslim population in China. So now seems like a good time to take a step back and ask, what do we want international law to look like? What vision for it should we aspire to achieve? Needless to say, each of us might prioritize different policy goals for international law, growing or redistributing the global economic pie, mitigating climate change, reducing threats to human security, and so on. Today, I want to put aside questions of policy and focus instead on issues of legal form. Whatever policies might be pursued, why should we want them to be pursued through international law? What does international law bring to the table that makes it preferable to other forms of social ordering? That's a big question, but we can start with the basic point that international law is a kind of law. An expansive philosophical literature already explores what makes law as an enterprise worthwhile. This literature uses the umbrella concept of the rule of law to try to capture the attributes of law that are, in general, valuable. Today, I'm going to draw on this literature to offer two normative visions or ideals for the international rule of law. I'll argue that each of these visions captures something important about international law, but while the first vision already informs much of the thinking in the field, I think the second, which has largely been overlooked, might more often provide a suitable framework for evaluating when and why international law is worthwhile. Let's start with the first, more familiar vision. This vision of the rule of law prioritizes obedience to law as a way of constraining state discretion and thereby ensuring that states do not exercise power arbitrarily. Here, the rule of law, and by extension, the international rule of law, requires establishing conduct rules that satisfy three basic criteria. First, the rules must be relatively precise in content. Second, they must be stable, as in consistently and impartially applied. Third, they must work to constrain the discretion of the people who have the power to make particular governance decisions. These three criteria for the rule of law depict an ideal in which law directs people on what they are supposed to do, and then they do it. The criteria are context independent. They are meant to define what the rule of law requires across issue areas, and they define it as an alternative to the arbitrary exercise of power. As I said, this vision for the rule of law should sound familiar to international lawyers. It drives how many of us evaluate the enterprise and informs the kinds of arrangements that we tend to prize or seek to implement. Think of all of the efforts to clarify the normative content of international law. We must establish precise conduct rules, people say, because, and I'm quoting here, accepting only vague general principles weakens the law's power to impose meaningful restraints. In other words, imprecision in the content of international law reduces its constraining effect. And that is thought to be a problem. The worry is that certain areas of international law are insufficiently clear or precise to direct states on what to do, or therefore to constrain their behavior. This worry drives the many efforts to make international law more precise. Or think of the claim, variously expressed, that international law is too easily infected by power politics, not consistently and impartially applied. Again, the instability in the application of international law is thought to be a problem because it means that states, especially powerful states, might not adequately be constrained. This is why many international lawyers favor third-party adjudicative institutions. International courts and tribunals serve, in Karen Alter's words, to, quote, subordinate powerful actors to the rule of law. They have, quoting Alter again, quote, the authority to say what international law means, to apply the law to concrete cases, and thus to indicate what compliance with international law entails. Geert de Baer, Anna Louise Chenet, and Jan Wouters say something similar. Adjudicative institutions contribute to the rule of law, by their account, because it provides for laws, quote, consistent and impartial enforcement, and thereby, quote, ensures that legal rules prevail over power in the settlement of disputes. Again, if the rule of law is about constraining state discretion, per the first vision, then international law needs to be impartially and consistently applied so that it constrains all states, including the most powerful ones. And then there is a whole cottage industry devoted to state compliance with international law. This work asks when and why states would comply with international law, even if they would prefer to do something else. The normative assumption is that if states comply with international law in these situations, then it must be doing what it is supposed to do. It must be constraining their discretion. Some go so far as to suggest that this is the only reason to have international law, the only way it matters. The, quote, whole point of international law, Jens Olin has said, is to, quote, create a structure whereby the cost of shifting strategy away from compliance becomes higher than it would be without legal regulation in that particular area. If states don't comply with international law, and it therefore doesn't constrain their conduct, then it's not worth the paper it's written on, or so this vision of the rule of law suggests. The idea of the rule of law as a constraint is, of course, appealing in certain contexts. For example, the jus ad bellum, which is an area in which I do a lot of my research, should, in my view, constrain how states use force across national borders. But remember, this vision is content independent. It's supposed to provide a model, not just for certain areas of international law, but for all of it. In my view, this across-the-board ideal for international law has very real and very underappreciated flaws. To be more specific, I think that just grafting this vision of the rule of law from the domestic context for which it was first developed to the international one loses something important in translation. As applied to international law, the reasons for constraining states' discretion seem to me to be less compelling, and the reasons for allowing states flexibility in the exercise of their discretion seem more compelling. Let me unpack what I mean. In the domestic context, the central concern for the rule of law is the relationship between a state and its people. Rule of law theorists focus on limiting how states exercise power in order to protect people, who are subjects of the state, from the centralization of power in the state. We want to be sure that a state cannot arbitrarily decide, for example, whose property is expropriated, who must live near an environmental hazard, and whose food is contaminated. Put differently, we want the state to be constrained in the everyday administration of government so that its subjects know what to expect and can organize their lives around it, and are not subject to the whims or biases of the people who happen to be making decisions that will significantly impact their lives. Having precise and stable conduct rules that constrain governmental discretion is a good way of doing that. Note that some rule of law theorists have argued that the criteria that I mentioned earlier are insufficient. If the goal is to constrain how states exercise power over people, the argument goes, it's not enough just to establish precise conduct rules that are consistently applied. The rules must have particular content. They must incorporate basic human rights values that protect people from governmental abuse. I don't want to adjudicate this debate between the thin conception of the rule of law that is completely content independent and the thicker one that has a human rights overlay. I just want to flag that this debate exists and note that even under the thicker conception, the three criteria that I mentioned earlier are thought to be critical to constraining state power. They are thought to be necessary, even if not sufficient, for the first vision of the rule of law. When we shift from the domestic to the international context, those reasons for constraining state discretion become less salient. Although some areas of international law directly touch individual lives, as when international courts criminally prosecute people, most of international law is mediated through domestic legal and political systems. National actors must take steps to implement it. These actors must retain the power to make international law relevant or not in people's lives. So while individuals still need robust protections from governmental decisions at the national level, including maybe decisions relating to international law, they are, for various structural reasons, more shielded from what happens on the international plane. Now, some analogize the position of individuals in national law to that of states in international law, to posit that weak states need comparable protections from arbitrariness and abuse. The analogy doesn't work. The relationship between states is not at all like the relationship between a state and its own people. The international legal system is highly decentralized. So even states that are relatively weak by conventional standards still retain considerable control over how international law affects them or their people. The bottom line is that the coercion that a state experiences in the ordinary course of its international relations is not at all comparable to that which it routinely imposes on its own people. The state less often, though I'm not saying never, but less often, needs law to protect it from arbitrariness and abuse. Of course, we might still prioritize clarity, stability, and obedience to law for reasons other than for other reasons that are independent of its content. For example, to foster predictability or coordination in international affairs. But these reasons are ultimately not about protecting individuals from state power. They are less compelling than the reasons for insisting that states constrain themselves through domestic law, so they more readily budge in the face of competing considerations. I want to be perfectly clear here. I am not arguing that states should aimlessly disregard international law. I'm arguing that the normative case for establishing stable conduct rules that all states consistently obey, no matter their content, is weaker than many assume. At the same time, the reasons for not establishing such rules are more compelling in the international context. States vary enormously in their needs, interests, values, and capacities. Insisting that they all consistently obey the same conduct rules will in many, though again, not all, settings be counterproductive or itself a source of oppression. Any one rule is likely to be inconsistent with what people in some states need or want, or with what their governments can realistically provide. Positive international law already to some extent recognizes this point. Many international legal instruments define state obligations in terms that are highly contextually variable, that afford states significant discretion to decide what measures they will take to satisfy their own obligations, or that allow states to limit the scope or effect of particular obligations as applied to them. Take the principal obligation of the Paris Agreement on climate change. It requires each party simply to, quote, prepare, communicate, and maintain successive nationally determined contributions that it intends to achieve. Likewise, the core obligation of the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, the ICESCR, provides that each state must, quote, take steps to the maximum of its available resources with a view to achieving progressively the full realization of the relevant rights. If one adopts a vision of the rule of law as constraint, these sorts of provisions are problems. They're evidence of a deficiency that ought to be corrected. They are imprecise and cannot be consistently applied because they give each state too much discretion to decide on its own what it will do. But it's not at all clear, at least not to me, that that's the right way to evaluate them. Such provisions accommodate real differences among states. States demand and to some extent need the flexibility to adapt international law to their own circumstances. Indeed, given the world's diversity, pushing them all to obey the very same conduct rules will often be oppressive. It will mean locking them into arrangements that they accepted before the full implications were apparent, or pushing them to go along with majoritarian preferences in the interests of international cooperation. There's little reason to believe that those results would systematically advance basic rule of law values, such as justice, fairness, and human freedom. To the contrary, scholars who write from the TWAIL tradition, those who emphasize third world approaches to international law, have long argued that international rules too often prioritize the interests, values, and perspectives of the powerful, and that they operate to the detriment of those that have historically been marginalized. In other words, establishing precise conduct rules that are consistently applied might constrain all states, but it will do so with disparate effects and in ways that further diminish the positions of the less powerful. It will at times be a source not of human freedom and emancipation, but of repression. The WTO TRIPS agreement is a good example. Almost immediately after the agreement was signed, many developing countries started complaining that its intellectual property protections were too onerous or even harmful as applied to them. Insisting on rule following in this context begins to look like something that we might want to avoid, it looks like the rule by law instead of the rule of law. So on balance, the first vision of the rule of law, the rule of law of constraint, is less compelling for international law than it is for domestic law, or than it is often taken to be. The reasons for constraining state discretion are less salient, and the reasons for allowing states more flexibility are more salient. Again, I'm not saying that this vision is problematic in every single setting in which it might be invoked, just that we should not assume that it is across the board desirable. We should not assume that precision, consistency, and constraint are always for the good. Those who want to push international law in those directions thus should make a case for that push in the specific settings in which it is made and in light of the countervailing considerations. For example, while the first vision of the rule of law might define the ideal for the jus ad bellum, it's not as compelling for intellectual property rights or for the full realization of economic, social, and cultural rights under the ICESCR. We should be more mindful of its limits as a normative ideal. What's the alternative? What might the rule of law entail if not rule following, if not directing people on what to do and then having them do it? The second vision for the international rule of law that I want to introduce is less about using international law to constrain state power and more about using it, in Jeremy Waldron's words, to, quote, commit to a certain method of arguing about the exercise of public power. The idea here is that the rule of law is advanced through legal argumentation and debate. Again, think of the obligations in the Paris Agreement and the ICESCR. Their content is highly imprecise and contextually variable. They fall short of the first vision of the rule of law because they give states considerable discretion in their own implementation. But insofar as they help structure an iterative process of legal argumentation and debate, I'll argue, they might well satisfy the second vision. I'm going to tell you why I think international law's argumentative practice promotes the rule of law, but before I do, I should probably explain what I mean by it. As all lawyers know, legal arguments have a particular structure and style. Most fundamentally, they focus on questions relating to public authority. They address not or not only whether particular conduct is feasible, but also whether it is appropriate, whether it is consonant with the precepts of the regulated group. Legal arguments offer reasons for positions that purport to reflect the interests and values of the group. They tie the reasons to the facts. They rely on particular text, norms, and methods of analysis. They are subject to external scrutiny and debate, and so forth. Arguments can be more or less legalized, depending on the extent to which they display these attributes. But, and this is a point worth underscoring, an argument need not use a derivation of the word law or invoke any particular text or norm to be legal in kind. What makes it legal in kind is its structure and style, and its particular focus on issues of public authority. Let me give a concrete example from the jus ad bellum. You might remember that in 2017, the United States attacked a Syrian airfield after evidence surfaced that the Syrian regime had again used chemical weapons against its people. The United States did not explain how its action was consistent with the black letter doctrine on the jus ad bellum. It did not claim to be acting pursuant to the Security Council's authorization in self-defense or with the Syrian government's consent. Some analysts took this to mean that it therefore did not present a legal argument. I disagree. The United States, in fact, did try to justify its exercise of military power by reference to international law. In its words, serious, quote, widespread violations of international law. It invoked several international legal texts to argue that it was upholding not just its own priorities, but the interests and values of the international community as a whole. It alluded to background legal norms when it asserted that it used force only as a last resort, only after the exhaustion of all reasonably available peaceful remedies, and only as necessary and proportionate to the aim of deterring and preventing the future use of chemical weapons by the Syrian government. I was quoting just then. It also appeared before the Security Council, the international institution with legal primacy in this area, to explain its conduct and subject its reasoning to external scrutiny. In short, the United States conceded that it was not entitled to attack Syria just because it could. It recognized that any authority for its operation would have to come from other states, and it made a pitch to them to earn this authority. These are the ingredients of a legal argument. We can contrast that approach with the one that the United States took earlier this year when it conducted a targeted airstrike against Iranian General Qasem Soleimani, who was at the time on business in Iraq. In the days following the US strike, the government mostly just thumbed its nose at international law. President Trump and other administration officials vacillated incoherently about their justification for using military force. They variously suggested that the action was justifiable to deter imminent attacks that Soleimani was plotting, that it was retribution for earlier attacks, and it was just part of a broader geopolitical contest with Iran. US officials did not provide the details to substantiate any of these justifications, and at times, they trafficked in conspiracy theories and lies. These two examples, Syria in 2017 and Soleimani in 2020, highlight the second vision of the rule of law, the one that centers on law's argumentative practice. In each example, international law did not constrain US power. The United States, by most accounts, violated international law. So it did not satisfy the first vision for the rule of law, the one that focuses on constraining power through law. Moreover, and now I'm repeating myself, this is a context in which we might actually prize obedience and constraint. The first vision might actually be the ideal here. But even if that first vision is the ideal, we should have a normative framework that can help us understand why the US approach in the Soleimani incident was so troubling, beyond the fact of the violation. And if we think that the only way international law can matter is if states comply with it, or if it constrains their power, then we will come up short. The second vision for the international rule of law, the one that focuses on its argumentative practice, gives us more traction here. I want to suggest that international law's argumentative practice promotes four key values that are associated with the rule of law. It does so even when it does not serve the constraining function that the first vision of the rule of law prioritizes. First, and at the most basic level, legal argumentation signals that material power is not a sufficient basis for making decisions. Those who have the power to make particular decisions must show not only that they can implement a decision, but that they may, that they have the authority to do what they want to do. In international law, the relevant authority rests beyond the jurisdiction of any one state. Those who want it have to earn it from other global actors. When they argue about whether they have it, they indicate, even if only implicitly, that it exists and that it matters. It matters enough for them to fight over it. Arguments about international law thus reinforce and preserve the expectation that governance decisions must be rooted in some authority that resides at the international level. When the United States struck Syria in 2017, it at least recognized that its decision had to be justified by reference to international law. It accepted the general proposition that use of force issues are properly addressed by the group of states and are not entirely up to any one of them. The US message in the Soleimani incident was different. It was that the United States would do as it pleased and the rest of the world would suffer the consequences. In not presenting a legal argument, the United States treated the authority of international law as irrelevant. Second, legal argumentation serves to hold those who make decisions accountable for their actions. Because international legal authority rests with the collective and states that want it on their side must earn it from other actors, arguing with them about whether they have it is a way of holding them accountable for their decisions. When a state seeks to establish this authority, when it makes a legal argument to support what it has done, it effectively empowers other actors either to confer authority on or to deny authority to it. The legal argument thus becomes a tool for legitimizing or delegitimizing the behavior in law. In some circumstances, legal argumentation might work to shape whether or how a state exercises its power. A state that cannot reasonably justify a decision might choose to do something else. Note, however, that the argument doesn't necessarily constrain power through stable conduct rules that are consistently applied. It constrains power by cultivating the expectation that governance decisions that lack authority are in some sense illegitimate, and by giving external actors a central role in making that legitimacy determination. What's more, even if a legal argument does not affect a state's operational behavior, it still is a way of holding the state's feet to the fire. The argument pushes the state to explain and try to justify the decision to the various external constituencies that are paying attention. The Soleimani strike is again instructive. Although Iran and Iraq each complained to the Security Council that the United States had acted unlawfully, the United States communicated through its evident disregard for the enterprise that it was not particularly invested in justifying its conduct in law, and the vast majority of other states did not press it to do so. The result was that the use of bellum seemed not only materially, but also normatively irrelevant. It did not constrain the decision to use force, but neither did it serve to legitimize or delegitimize that decision. By not having the legal argument, states did not hold the United States accountable for the strike. Third, legal argumentation is a way of showing respect to people who care about or are affected by particular decisions. The argument treats people like they're not just pawns in a geopolitical game of chess, but individuals who deserve a reasoned account of what is happening and why, and who might themselves have views worth sharing on the subject. Quote, even if compliance is not the issue, Frederick Schauer has explained, giving reasons for governance decisions is still a way of showing respect for the subject and a way of opening a conversation rather than forestalling one. Mark Tushnet has made a similar point. Arguing in law, quote, expresses respect for people as reasoning and reasonable being, which quote, does seem an unqualified human good. In trying to justify the Syria operation under international law, the United States recognized that it owed various audiences an explanation for its conduct. It conceded that it was not entitled to attack Syria just because it had the military power to do so. It explained that its action was based on general principles that, though contested, reflected a considered view of the public good, not, for example, the president's own personal vendetta, and it addressed competing normative positions. Many would have preferred for it not to have conducted the attack, but given that it did, its legal arguments at least informed others of what it was doing and why, and invited audiences around the globe to think about its logic, voice objections, and demand a reasoned response, including in the institution that is specifically charged with addressing such situations, the Security Council. The Soleimani case is again different. The Trump administration's changing and untethered justifications express not respect, but contempt for those who expected a reasoned account of what it did. If you think this doesn't matter, others matter, other people do. US Republican Senator Mike Lee called the administration's briefing to Congress, quote, insulting and demeaning for the way it tried to stifle rather than engage seriously in a reasoned discussion. And to be clear, Lee's complaint was not about the legal or policy merits of the Soleimani strike. He emphasized that he supported the Trump administration and admired what he saw as its overall restraint in dealing with Iran. His complaint was that the administration was not serious about publicly justifying its action in law. The administration's message in Lee's words was that, quote, we need to be good little boys and girls and not debate this in public. For Lee, that message was, and I'm quoting here, quote, absolutely insane, quote, wrong, and again, quote, insulting. Not trying to justify the action in law was a show of disrespect. Finally, international law's argumentative practice helps constitute a decent global politics about some of the most contentious things that states do in the world. It enables people in disparate parts of the world to engage together on the issues that they all care about, while structuring in relatively positive ways how they engage. Again, legal arguments have a particular structure and style. The participants use the law's various resources, its texts, norms, methods, and institutions to explain why their positions are consonant with the interests or values of a group. The argument thus pushes them to grapple with the politics of the group. Those who engage in these arguments plainly disagree about which policies best promote the public good. Their disagreements at times run so deep that they cannot definitively or authoritatively be resolved, and their legal positions are almost all certainly informed by their own interests or passion. Still, there is value to putting them in conversation with one another and pushing them, as Chantal Mouffe said, to quote, see themselves as belonging to the same political association and sharing a common symbolic space. My colleague Don Herzog explains that, quote, debate over principle, over the common good and justice, is a distinctive and invaluable moment of political life. It acquires a, quote, depth and seriousness of purpose, not because it is detached from or just a cloak for the participants' own preferences, but because it involves the, quote, dissonant intertwining of principle and interest. In trying to define their own priorities in relation to the groups, the participants must in some way contend with the politics of the group. They must confront what is at stake in concrete decisions, not just for themselves, but also for others who care about the decisions. Take another example from the use of vellum. About a dozen militarily powerful states now claim that they may use force in self-defense against non-state actors if the state from which these actors commit an attack is unable or unwilling to address the threat. This claim has spawned nearly two decades of debate among a broad range of actors. Although the participants have plainly been motivated by their own interests and values, they have also argued about principle. They have pushed for their priorities to be reflected in the use of vellum's normative resources. And though the proponents of the unable or unwilling position have not much changed their position as a result of the debate, their critics evidently still want to argue with them and focus the world's attention on it, rather than passively accept it as inevitable. The critics want these states to contend with, to take into account and address their opposing views. So to sum up, the second vision of the international rule of law highlights that international law is about much more than just establishing and then following a bunch of rules. It is about, and perhaps more critically, how we explain, justify, argue about, bolster, and undermine particular governance decisions. Law's argumentative practice is important because first, it fosters the expectation that sheer power is not a sufficient basis for making decisions. Second, it helps to hold the people in power accountable for their decisions. Third, it shows respect for those who care about the decisions by providing a reasoned account of what is happening and why. And fourth, it fosters a relatively healthy politics about the many contentious things that states do in the world. Okay, so I've offered two distinct visions of the international rule of law. In one, international law should ideally constrain state power. In the other, it should give states and other actors space to argue about the exercise of state power. We might, in the abstract, want to advance both visions simultaneously. We might want to establish stable conduct rules that limit state discretion while also fostering legal argumentation and debate. But as a practical matter, these two visions of the rule of law routinely push in different directions and require making trade-offs. Prioritizing law's argumentative practice often means tolerating greater levels of discretion, unpredictability, and inconsistency in the law's application. law best fosters argumentation by saying elastic and contestable, such that people can use it to advance different positions, not by establishing clear rules that are mechanically applied. For example, the use of bellum's conduct rules invite a lot of argumentation about how they apply in concrete cases because they are so open textured. The same is not true of the highly technical and specific conduct rules that govern international civil aviation under the Chicago Convention. Argumentation benefits from openness, but the more open a given area of law is, the less likely it will constrain the people who act under it. That trade-off between creating room for legal argumentation and constraining state discretion is not always worth making. The critical point, however, is that the question of whether the trade-off is worth making, and therefore which vision of the rule of law we should prioritize, cannot be made in the abstract. It depends on the specific interests and values that are at stake and on the political economy in which the law operates. In some circumstances, and again, international civil aviation might be a good example, constraining state discretion through settled conduct rules is both possible and important. But that vision for international law can also be infeasible. Because of the horizontal structure of international law, constraining states through precise conduct rules that are consistently applied is often not an option. States in large part decide for themselves what they are willing to do. See again the Paris Agreement. Moreover, even when that vision is an option, it will sometimes be undesirable. The extraordinary diversity and disparities in the world mean that trying always to constrain states through the clear and consistently applied conduct rules is not always what we want. Remember the WTO TRIPS agreement. In these latter circumstances, the instinct to try to harden international law is, in my view, misguided and at times even pernicious. So rather than instinctively push toward precision, stability, and constraint, in other words, rather than always strive for the first vision of the rule of law, we should in many contexts pursue the second. We should look to foster the opportunities for legal argumentation and debate. For example, we should see real value in the review processes that have been established under the Paris Agreement and the ICESER. These review processes prod states to engage in the argumentative practice that is distinct to law, to explain and defend their conduct in law to the many people who care enough to pay attention. Perhaps we should try to create similar processes in other areas of international law that have not been amenable to precision, stability, and constraint. For example, perhaps the UN General Assembly should conduct a periodic review of situations involving the use of force in order to push states to articulate and defend their positions on the use of bellum as applied to concrete fact patterns. That kind of review is unlikely to lead to more precision, stability, or constraint in the use of bellum, but it would provide an important venue for legal argumentation and debate. The second vision of the international rule of law helps us see why that might be valuable. So the upshot is that it's wrong to think that international law is inherently deficient or worthless if it does not satisfy the first vision of the international rule of law, if it does not establish precise rules that states consistently obey. In fact, we should sometimes prefer for it not to do that, and we should push for it to satisfy the second vision, the one that is about fostering its argumentative practice. This second vision is admittedly not a model for efficiency, but it might make international law fairer and more legitimate to the many people who are affected by it. And it might in the long term be more effective at achieving particular regulatory goals. To accept as much, we need not be Pollyanna. We simply need to recognize that putting states in straitjackets is not always the best or only way to get them to do things. They might more readily and more legitimately move toward a given goal if they have a good deal of discretion in deciding how to get there, so they can accommodate their many other commitments. And then they are consistently prodded to explain and justify their decisions to various audiences, both internal and external, who care enough to push them to improve. The second vision for the rule of law thus puts in view a model for international law that has too often been derided or neglected. Thanks for your time. I look forward to hearing your reactions.
Thank you very much, Monica, for this very fascinating and thought-provoking account of the two possible international rules of law and the vision.